Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll be talking with Tal McThenia and Margaret Dunbar Cutright, authors of A Case for Solomon, Bobby Dunbar and the Kidnapping That Haunted a Nation. And we'll have a conversation with Maureen O'Dwyer, who facilitates the Southern Literature Reading Group at the Ogden Museum of Southern Art, as well as two other reading groups at the Smith Library. My guests today are Tal McThenia and Margaret Dunbar Cutright, co-authors of A Case for Solomon, Bobby Dunbar, and the Kidnapping That Haunted a Nation. This is a fascinating page-turner of a story about a kidnapping that took place in Louisiana in 1912. Tal is a journalist and a documentary filmmaker who first produced this story about this case for This American Life, and Margaret is the granddaughter of that kidnapped boy. Welcome to The Reading Life, Tal.
Thank you.
How did you and Margaret first meet? How did you first get involved in this story?
I got involved in this story back in 2004. There had been a DNA test to determine the identity of Margaret's grandfather, and that made the national news. I read about it on the news and was fascinated with the story. The report gave a full history of the kidnapping case, which was also a case of contested identity. And Margaret had been doing research at that point for years, unearthing really the true story of what had happened to her grandfather when he was a little boy.
Well, kind of give us the outline of what happened.
Sure. In 1912, outside of Opelousas, Louisiana, a little boy named Bobby Dunbar went missing from a family camping trip. And there was a nationwide search for this child. A $6,000 reward was offered, which at the time was gigantic. And after 8 full months and many sightings that proved unsuccessful, a child closely resembling him was found in the company of a wandering handyman in southern Mississippi, outside of Columbia, Mississippi. And the Dunbars went to identify the child. Their identification at first was inconclusive, and eventually they became more certain that it was their son, Bobby. The wandering handyman, whose name was William Walters, insisted that the child was not Bobby, but rather his name was Bruce Anderson. Bruce was the son of a woman that worked for William Walters' parents back in North Carolina, and she had given Walters Bruce to travel around with him willingly. So right from that point, for the next 2 years, this case of kidnapping that was brought against William Walters was inextricably tied up with the question of identity. Was this child Bobby Dunbar or Bruce Anderson?
And it was on the front page of all these newspapers, wasn't it?
It was. It really was. At the time, in New Orleans, there were 4 English dailies, and the 2 morning ones were relatively staid. Those were the Times Democrat and the Daily Picayune before they merged. And the afternoon papers, the Item and the States, went after this story as if they were cursed newspapers. They really went at it. Any aspect of this case that could be sensationalized, they did it for 2 entire years. The merger of the Times Democrat and the Daily Picayune occurred in 1914 on the eve of Walter's kidnapping trial, and that sort of escalated the paper wars. And the merged paper, it turned out, offered some of the least sensational and most trustworthy of the reportage of the trial. The Item, on the other hand, basically did everything in their power to throw the trial and get Walters convicted, including faking witnesses, faking reports, faking interviews, you name it, they did it.
It was amazing to read the coverage. I mean, one of the great things about this book, I think, are all these pictures and articles and editorial cartoons. It's just amazing.
So amazing. There really is a wealth of archival material. Each of our 26 chapters starts with an incredible illustration, which is often an editorial cartoon.
So after the DNA test, tell me how you and Margaret got together.
Well, I just called her. I just called her out of the blue. I was so fascinated with the story. And we talked for about an hour about the story, and she at the time was really reeling from the news of the DNA test, And I was interested in writing a screenplay about it. At the time, I was writing screenplays. And that was not something that she was ready to do or ready to even think about, really. So we sort of fell out of touch, actually, but the story always stayed in my mind. And then in 2007, I was having a cocktail with a friend of mine who's a producer at This American Life and told him the full story. He was fascinated and immediately said this would be a great show. The next day, I called Margaret again, and at that point, she debated for a while whether she wanted to bring this story out again into the public. And one of the things that we discussed and agreed upon that was really kind of essential for this telling of the story was to tell all three sides of it, to tell the story from not just Margaret and her family side, the Dunbar side, but really from the side of the descendants of Julia Anderson, the quote-unquote other mother, whose descendants lived in Mississippi. And then also for the descendants of the alleged kidnapper, William Walters. So that collaboration was me as reporter and Margaret as subject. And that radio show, during the process of that, we realized that the historical material behind the present-day investigation was so vast, was so magnificent. It was a historian's dream, the material that she had gathered. And we both knew that a radio show could only really scratch the surface of that, even if it was an hour radio show. So we decided to do a book.
Well, I think people will be fascinated by this book. Did you spend much time in Louisiana when you were working on this?
I did. I spent about 7 months in New Orleans and did a lot of work at Tulane and some work at the Williams Center. Also, New Orleans was a sort of a great hub. I had to go up to Opelousas and Lafayette and then also over into Mississippi, up into Jackson. And New Orleans was sort of a good base point, too. And I did it, probably wrote the first 10 chapters in New Orleans, too.
Oh, wonderful.
It's the best place to write a book, I imagine.
Well, you won't get any argument from me about that. So what kind of special responsibilities did you feel to these families as you were working on this?
That's a great question. I guess I could take it in three parts, maybe. For Margaret's family, for the Dunbar family, their largest concern has been that bringing this story back up into the public will taint or eclipse the image that they have of their father, the life that their father led after he was a tabloid headline. So I felt particularly compelled with them to include in the book who Bobby Dunbar became, no matter what had happened to him in his childhood. So I spent a long time, both Margaret and I spent a long time interviewing her relatives and really getting them to mine their memories of their own childhood, because it's sort of in the telling of their childhood with Bobby Dunbar as their father that the story really does find its redemption. So I felt a need to honor that man, not the boy. And for Julia Anderson's family, they had really known the truth of this story for so long, which is the truth of their ancestors, you know, the fact that who this child was, Bruce Anderson. And for them, I felt that it was important to get history right, really, for the first time. It was their oral history, their family history, that was really upending the accepted history. So both of us really wanted to get that right and to tell not just what had happened to Julia Anderson during this whole case, but really before it. The life that led to how she happened to give up her son, Bruce, what that life was, in many ways, just as important as telling the rest of Bobby's story when he's an adult.
And it's such an amazing picture of the life of women and opportunities for women at that period.
Yeah.
It's just, it's very vivid and real and kind of scary at the same time.
Yeah, it was terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. She really had nothing. And I think this whole experience really toughened her. I think as brutal as it was for her, I think there is a great deal of redemption in her story, too, and this experience changed the trajectory of her life.
Absolutely. Now, Margaret, this is a family legend that you grew up with.
Yes, it is. It's a story that my grandmother told me when I was about 10 years old, much in the way you would tell just a family story, sort of like a Huckleberry Finn tale. She told us that my grandfather had gone missing when he was a little boy and was kidnapped, and that a man was tried for the kidnapping, and that another woman had claimed my grandfather was her son, but that he was returned to his rightful family, the Dunbar family, and that's what I grew up believing.
And family documents played such an important part in your search. Would you tell us about some of those scrapbooks and letters?
Well, the scrapbook was actually something that was started by Lessie Dunbar, Bobby Dunbar's mother. And it was passed down to my grandmother. There were originally three scrapbooks, but the one that survived had about 400 newspaper articles in it and some telegrams and letters and photographs that were from the kidnapping. It was not a chronological listing of the events, and going over it, I quickly realized that there was much more to the story. So I typed all of that and put it into my computer in separate Word documents so that I could order it chronologically. And then I hit the libraries to search the old-fashioned way, sitting in front of a reader, microfilm, to find the rest of the story. As newspapers have become digitized more and more, of course, that has helped us to locate articles much easier.
And now you persevered in this quest. I mean, this is a difficult quest for truth on your part. And some of your family had great resistance to it, right?
There were family members that, of course, did resist. I think you can understand when you grow up believing that this is your family, this is where you come from, and then you learn something such as this, it's like finding out you're adopted. It takes time to adjust to that. It took a while for an understanding to come about that the truth only set us all free. You know, Julia Anderson did lose her son in this case. Leslie and Percy Dunbar did not recover their son, Bobby. And William Walters was an innocent man. He was not guilty of kidnapping. So it was very important to share these truths with everyone so that a peace could find its way to settle in.
And
it has.
You really felt that as a reader, that you were getting every side and every aspect of this story, because it is so complicated and so emotional.
The purpose of the book was to clarify how this happened, to correct the series of injustices that happened.
Now, how much time did you spend in Louisiana when you were working on it?
I traveled to Louisiana several times. You know, as a girl, I went often on vacation. But once I started researching back in 1999, I began talking to people in Opelousas and exploring the legend, if you will. It was in 2003 that I returned again and spoke in front of the Imperial St. Landry Historical Society about the case and the project that I was working on. And a man came at that time and said that he would like to take me to Swayze Lake, that he wanted to tell me what his grandfather had shared with him about the day Bobby had gone missing. And that was the first time I actually went to Swayze Lake. And the railroad trestle that is in the story was still existed at that time. And so it was like I got to go back in time and revisit that location. It was so meaningful to be able to do that.
That must have been really emotional for you.
It was terribly emotional. As I peered down into the water from this railroad trestle, this is the location where Bobby had wandered away from the family on this fishing trip on August 23rd, 1912, and they found his little footprints going up an embankment, and they found where he had fallen, and he went back up to the railroad trestle to the tracks, and his footprints disappeared. Had he crossed over that bridge, it was likely that he fell into that water and unfortunately died there. But as I stared into this water, this Walmart bag with a little smiley face that said, "Have a nice day," floated by. And it was so very, very meaningful to me, because I knew at that point that my grandfather was truly born Bruce Anderson, and that little Bobby Dunbar, born to Leslie and Percy Dunbar, had likely died in that spot. And he had never been mourned. And I felt that that was his way of saying to me, "Thank you. Thank you for looking. Thank you for being here."
Oh, it's wonderful to feel that connection.
The only thing that has not been resolved is that little boy that we were just talking about, Robert Clarence Dunbar, born of Percy and Leslie Dunbar, was not mourned properly or grieved for. There's no headstone. There's no place to go and remember him but that spot. And that makes me sad that he has sort of been forgotten throughout the century. There were two boys involved in this case. My grandfather being born Bruce Anderson, I understand that Julia Anderson was his biological mother, but he lived Bobby Dunbar's life.
Oh, so amazing. And sounds like such a lovely man.
He was a wonderful man. Despite the tragic beginnings of his life, he did marry my grandmother, Marjorie, and they raised a family together, and he was a wonderful family man. He loved his family, his children, his church, his community. And that is most how my father and his siblings and the rest of the family would like for him to be remembered, not for all of the tragedy that he suffered, but for the man that he became in spite of that. He taught us all how to love unconditionally, and that's how he lived his life. That is his true legacy.
Well, you certainly honor his memory in this wonderful book, which is such, it's just such a page-turner. Once you start it, you can't put it down, and you're just wishing for things to turn out well. You can meet Tal McThenia and Margaret Dunbar Cutright when they sign A Case for Solomon, Bobby Dunbar and the Kidnapping That Haunted a Nation, Wednesday, September 5th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
There are so many book clubs in New Orleans, and if you're listening to The Reading Life, you probably belong to one. This week, we're talking with Maureen O'Dwyer, who facilitates two book clubs, one devoted to Southern literature that's held at the Ogden Museum of Southern Art, and another at the Robert E. Smith Library. Maureen's a New Orleans native and a docent of the Ogden Museum, as well as a longtime docent at the New Orleans Museum of Art. She taught in Orleans and Jefferson Parish schools for 43 years. Maureen, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
How did you get involved in this book group at the Ogden?
I was asked by Ellen Balkin, who is the education coordinator at the Ogden, if I were interested in doing anything with the book club. And I had had previous training in the Great Book with the Great Books Foundation, founded by Mortimer Adler years ago. Mm-hmm. And so I used that technique in proposing questions to the group.
And tell us about that technique so people will know what they're in for.
It's a very easy technique and makes everyone feel comfortable. All I do as the moderator is pose questions that have open-ended answers. No one is right, no one is wrong, but what I do ask the readers to do is to try to justify their answers by using something, quotes from the book, or, you know, helping us go back to something into the book to show why they feel that way.
And who chooses the books for this book group?
Last year was the first year, and I chose the first two.
What were the first two?
The first two were Approaching the Magic Hour by Walter Anderson's wife, and then we took a field trip. And then the second was Delta Wedding by Eudora Welty. What we tried to do is coordinate the books that relate to Southern literature and also by photographs, paintings in the museum. Mm-hmm. So Walter Anderson and Eudora Welty are both exhibited at the Ogden.
Oh, so many wonderful Walter Anderson things there.
Yes.
And what has been the most successful book you've talked about, you think?
All of the books are quite successful only because every person gets to have their own opinion. Mm-hmm. I can't say one was more successful than the other. People have different opinions about them. They've all helped us to learn more about the understanding of the place where we live. I like to always go by the quote by Eudora Welty, "One place comprehended can make us understand other places better."
Right.
And so I feel that's what we try to do in the book club. So it's not whether it's better than one or the other, but what it helped to bring you to understand things better.
Mm-hmm. And how many people are in this group?
It varies because of the time people have to get to the book club. We start off, you know, with 6, 8, 12, and it just varies week to week.
Mm-hmm. And you're starting off this new season with some terrific books, aren't you?
Yes. Well, I kind of push those myself also because I had read both of the books and just felt that it was a good start for a new year on Southern literature and not just New Orleans, I mean, Louisiana or Mississippi literature. It also brought in another state, which we had not really gone out of our comfort zone, so to speak.
So tell us what the books are.
The books are All Over But the Shoutin' and Ava's Man, which are both by Rick Bragg, who I have heard speak numerous times and enjoy him and would just love, if he's even listening to this, we would love to have him as a guest at the book club.
Well, he comes to New Orleans a lot, so you never know. You just never know. And this book club is open only to members of the Ogden Museum.
Yes. Yes.
There's another reason to get yourself over there, right?
Yes, absolutely.
So tell us about your other book group as well.
The book club at Lakeview is starting. We have one already, but they have asked me to do another because the one that we started last year is solid. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to do the other, and we have our books picked out for the year. And the way those books are picked is by the number of books available in the library. No one is asked to purchase a book. So we're starting off with the reader because we have enough. We have like 8 or 9 copies of the reader in the system.
By Bernard Schlink.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. And it's such an incredible book to read. And I just thought it would be a good one to, so that we could talk about it with other people and get different views.
So will both of the book groups at Lakeview do that book?
No, because we only have a certain number of books. We've already read that in the first book club.
Oh, I see.
So we're trying to piggyback, you know, or just try to make lists of books that we can get enough copies.
Right. So what do you think makes a good book group choice?
To me, the book needs to have something to give to a person that they will be able to perhaps learn something or just find out something insightful that will help them become a better person, live better within the community, and understand people in our past so that we can move on in the future.
So what have been some of the best books you've talked about in the Lakeview group?
My favorite was the very first one that we did, The Dog in the Middle of the Night.
Oh.
What, no, The Curious,
the curious incident of the dog in the middle of the night.
That's one of my favorite books of all time. Right,
Mark Haddon.
Yes.
It's a wonderful book.
But it's not something that we can do in the Ogden Book Club, you know, because we are really dealing with the Southern literature and culture with the Ogden, whereas we are open-ended in whatever topic we want to read, you know, in the Lakeview.
So do you make everybody participate? Are you sure that everybody talks?
I try, yes, because that's what I've always done. You know, that I will pose a question to one person so that I can at least get something so the person feels comfortable in the group.
And this is a lot of work for you because you're on to now the third book group.
Yes.
So what does it do for you? What does it give to your life?
Meaning, really. Oh. I have to say, it's just I love to read. That's all I've really enjoyed doing. I've loved it throughout teaching, and I always wanted to have my students become interested in reading. And we just always talked about books and read everything. And I always tried to introduce them to the classics. And they accepted it. They were very willing to accept the way that we handled everything. It was an easy way to read a book. We didn't sit there and I want to know what happened in this chapter on that page by that person.
And I'm very curious to know if any book club members are reading their books on e-readers.
Oh, yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. And another thing that everyone comes with information that they've gotten from the internet. You know, so that helps a great deal. I bring in different things, you know, that I have found that will help people understand certain things. I just go a little further because of having the art background for so many years. I started the gifted program for elementary students in Jefferson Parish, and I am so used to going beyond what is in front of me that it comes natural. So
anyway, to bring the book to life.
Yes, I always step out of the box.
Well, this is so great. And you sound like you're having a complete blast doing this.
I am. I enjoy it quite a bit.
Oh, well, we've been talking with Maureen O'Dwyer, who facilitates the Southern Literature Reading Group at the Ogden Museum of Southern Art. The next meeting is September 11th from 5:30 to 7 in the Education Gallery on the third floor of the museum. And the books for discussion are Avis Mann and All Over But the Shoutin' by Rick Bragg. The Ogden Museum of Art Book Club will be discussing these books over the fall. On October 23rd, they'll be talking about Louisiana women, their lives and times, edited by Janet Allured and Judith Gentry. On December 4th, 2012, they'll be talking about Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, the American classic in words and photographs of three tenant families in the Deep South by Walker Evans and James Agee. To join, please register with Ellen Balkin, Education Coordinator at ebalkin@ogdenmuseum.org or call 504-539-9608 or stop by the Robert E. Smith Library for more information about the Lakeview Reading Group. Thanks so much, Maureen.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Moira Crone will discuss The Not Yet, Tuesday, September 4th at 7 p.m. at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Today's guest, Tal McThenia and Margaret Dunbar Cutright, discuss and sign A Case for Solomon, Bobby Dunbar and the Kidnapping That Haunted a Nation, Wednesday, September 5th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Karma Wilson signs her children's book, Bear Says Thanks, Thursday, September 6th at 4 p.m. at Octavia Books. The Dickens Fellowship of New Orleans begins its programming year, Saturday, September 8th, from 2 to 4 at Metairie Park Country Day School's Bright Library. Start with Great Expectations, chapters 1 through 6. The fellowship intersperses lectures, book discussion, and film screenings. For info, email the Dickens Fellowship at mpcds.com. Celebrate the work of Lafcadio Hearn at the Black Widow Literary Salon, with Priestess Miriam from the Rampart Street Temple reading about Marie Laveau, and Trixie Minx reading about glamour in NOLA. That's Thursday, September 10th at 7 p.m. at Crescent City Books, hosted by Michael Zell. Gary Smith, author, editor, publisher, instructor, and photojournalist based in New Orleans, conducts a seminar, How to Create Your Own Publishing Company, Thursday, September 10th at 7 p.m. at the East Bank Regional Library. Today's guest, Maureen O'Dwyer, facilitates the Southern Literature Reading Group at the Ogden Museum of Southern Art, Tuesday, September 11th from 5:30 to 7, in the Education Gallery on the third floor of the museum. The books for discussion are Avis Mann and All Over But the Shoutin' by Rick Bragg. To join, please register with Ellen Balkin, Education Coordinator, at ebalkin, B-A-L-K-I-N, at ogdenmuseum.org, or call 504-539-9608. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.